This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Troy Swanson, sitting in for Steve Thomas. My guest today is Dr. Nathan Carpenter, Director of Convergent Media in the School of Communication at Illinois State University. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners just like you. Nathan, welcome to the show, and thank you for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me on, Troy.
I wanted to talk to you as part of this conversation we've been having on this podcast about fake news in libraries, largely because of your work at Illinois State's Social Media Analytics Command Center, also called SMAC. Is that correct?
That's correct.
This seems like something that librarians would really be interested in. Could you just explain what is SMAC and how it works?
Sure. So the SMAC was something we developed 3 years ago. And you have to imagine a specialized lab that's got all these touch screens on the walls and has all these visualizations of, let's say, real-time social media trends or topics that are emerging in the larger social web. And it's a space that's it's really no larger than a regular classroom on a college campus, so it fits about 25 students pretty comfortably. And it's got mobile furniture, so we can move things around. But what's really important about the space is that it's dedicated to studying social media, and especially, again, capturing large quantities of posts, efficiently analyzing those posts for different kinds of trends, like trending keywords and hashtags, being able to go in and really be able to divide out what's called sentiment, get a really good sense of people's opinions or attitudes. We can quickly filter that out and start to make some judgments out of what we're seeing in that kind of space. And again, the SMAC, it's not only a space devoted to research or classroom work. It's a space that we spend a lot of time doing education, a lot of time working on what we would call larger social media literacy practices.
So are there classes that are scheduled in it, and then there's open time for people to come in and do research? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's pretty close to what it is at this point. I currently teach a course in there. We have a graduate seminar in persuasion. We have a couple of mass media courses, including one of our journalism and television courses that actually produces content from that space. And it's very interesting because they will look up current issues and current trends and talk about them live on the air. When something is trending or when there are issues, fake news is one of those that they might look at. They might look at a particular story and just see how many people are talking about it over a period of time. And if there is either a counter story or if there is some sort of reaction to it kind of coming from the larger news and media industries as well.
So which kind of platforms do you focus on then? Is it more open platforms like Twitter where you can see how it's shared? Can you get into things like Facebook?
So the primary sources that we're working with are all public, as you describe right there, open access. And so if it's publicly available, so that is, anybody logged in, anywhere, if they can see those posts, then we can see and collect those as well. So most cases we're looking at Twitter, Instagram, lots of blog sources, news sources, RSS feeds. I think we can capture content now from Pinterest and Tumblr, and we can capture several international sources as well, such as VK, which is a Russian-based company that produces content very similar to Instagram and Tumblr. And then we can also capture content depending on how we're doing the research. We used to collect a little bit here and there from Sina Weibo, which is China's biggest social media platform. And I'm glad you actually bring up Facebook, because Facebook presents some very interesting issues for researchers, number one being that there are so many different privacy settings and layers. So we can't necessarily see individuals' posts, but what we can do is go into open groups and public pages, so like fan pages or pages developed by organizations. And we have different tools that will allow us, not necessarily in real time, but we can download large data sets and comments and mine those for different kinds of comments or issues or you know, whatever our research questions might be at the moment. So we can, you know, again, obtain data from all of these sources so long as they're publicly available.
You had mentioned the an idea of social media literacy, and I think that definitely touches on a lot of things that librarians think about. Could you talk a little bit about how you would define that and what some of those skills that you'd like to instill in your students?
Yeah, so defining social media literacy is really hard because just even that notion of literacy has gone through so many changes over time. And, you know, my background, I've gone through, you know, I initially was an English major, and so, you know, literacy was for me at that time about reading and writing. During my graduate studies, that notion of literacy really opened up through the coursework that I took and the kind of teaching I got to do. And in the end, you know, that notion of literacy is one that really says it's as much about knowledge, you know, about and practice of you know, different kinds of you know, bodies of a very specific knowledge. So, you know, for social media, when we think about it, you know, there can be so many additional layers. And so when I teach it, you know, obviously the easiest one for so many people is about the production of social media. You know, a lot of our majors in the School of Communication here go out and they either work in public relations or journalism or other media-based companies. And so for them, it's, you know, how do we produce content that people will consume, or how do we produce campaigns that will help either a nonprofit organization or a company succeed in its goals. So there's that level of literacy, which is kind of like the writing portion that many of us are really used to. You know, how do we teach reading and writing? But I think even more importantly, social media present us with, you know, sets of structures and infrastructures and power relationships that we also have to begin to understand. And so when I teach a social media course, we spend as much time looking at, you know, what goes on behind the scenes when a post is created. You know, what kinds of additional data beyond simply, you know, the content of a post are created, and what do companies and individuals and organizations do with all that data as well? So it's, you know, when we're looking at it again, I'm thinking really about not only that production, but also the knowledge and understanding structures and relationships, and especially with those relationships of power behind them.
It's interesting because especially in the academic library community, there's always the conversations about information literacy. And again, what does that word literacy mean? And what are the skills that go with it? And we largely mean being able to effectively find, use, understand information, in an academic specifically targeting at creating, doing research and the academic scholarly enterprise. So I'm always interested in seeing how these kind of related literacies overlap and the pieces that connect to each other. And I think librarians really do think of this. If there was a definition of social media literacy skills, I think there'd be easy connections with what we do with information literacy for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think about many of the skills that I need to do my work, and the skills that I will really train a lot of my students to do often involve search. You know, I think about you know, our ability to, you know, when I use the library, I spend a lot of time searching databases, and those become very complex. And many of the tools that allow us to search the social web involve those exact same skills. You know, Boolean search is amazing for being able to filter out and find the kinds of content or posts that you might, you know, really need to discover in a given moment.
Yeah, absolutely. You had mentioned the idea of online power dynamics, and I was wondering if you could explore that a little more. What do you mean by that, and how is that measured?
Mm-hmm. So first, when I talk about those power dynamics, you know, really it's a question of, you know, whose interests are being played out through the distribution and consumption of, you know, social media content. And so one of the things I really get my students to ask a lot about, especially when they see things in their own personal, you know, news feeds on Facebook or in their Twitter streams, is, you know, who's producing that and for what purposes? And why are you seeing it now as opposed to, you know, the other content that might be out there? And so kind of those questions really begin to open up, you know, again, these relationships of power that might, you know, it can be behind the scenes here. So a really good example is Facebook. When we're reading through our feeds, of course, we've got a lot of things that are produced by our friends and our family members, but there's also a lot that's produced, you know, for the sake of advertising by companies. And, you know, they're paying a good amount of money to Facebook to have their content seen before your content and before what you, you know, are in there to see from your families and friends. So, you know, that right there is an interesting relationship because, you know, again, you have, again, this advertising relationship. Companies can come in. If you have a lot of money, you can come in and you can pay and have your you know, content be seen first. And what I think is interesting is that really runs counter to what a lot of, you know, the popular discourse says about social media. I mean, we hear so much out there right now about how, you know, it's leveling the playing field and we're all content producers now and how that's fundamentally changing the nature of everything. And I think what's being missed is, again, these really subtle things in which, again, companies, especially, again, media corporations, you know, again, they still maintain an immense amount of power in this ecosystem. And so it's not a, you know, a leveling in the kind of way that has really been promised to us. If I think about, you know, the economic incentives to a lot of what's been going on lately, you know, maybe I'm jumping the gun here a little bit, but, you know, the whole fake news infrastructure is really based on you know, the way that marketing and online advertising works. And so it's not necessarily that people say, hey, it's a great idea to go, you know, deliver a whole bunch of you know, false information for the fun of it. There's really an economic incentive that's there that's all wrapped up in clicks and likes and links and how just simply, you know, Google advertising delivers and pays on those.
I wanted to ask, I do want to get into the fake news, but related to that is this relationship between traditional media and social media, because I do think, you know, as we've been ripping apart this traditional media infrastructure that we've spent a century and a half building, now we're getting media, like you said, the financial incentives where there's media that doesn't care about actually answering questions or being responsible or speaking toward truth. They're really just after clicks, however those clicks happen. And so how are we shifting and what's the role of traditional media in the social sphere? Are they one of those large voices that dominates or are they getting relegated away?
You know, the way that we often talk about this in media studies is that it's not a, we shouldn't think of it as social media replacing legacy media. There's kind of a difference between delivery technologies and content. And so when we think about, you know, Facebook or even our mobile devices, there's kind of a continuous lament that, oh, nobody reads books anymore. No, nobody reads newspapers before. And that's not at all true. We're just consuming those two same kinds of things in a very different way. We're reading books on our phones and computers. We're reading newspapers and subscribing to them very differently or getting clips from them, you know, from our social media platforms as people are sharing stories and linking to them. So I think we have to really, you know, not fall into, you know, again, one of those assumptions that social media are replacing everything. They're really, you know, supplementing and in many ways making the entire ecosystem much more complex than it had been before. And again, that relationship is very interesting because, you know, media companies find themselves in the position where they are very much the, you know, not only the content producers, but they are also, they've become consumers as well. You know, we want to talk about it as everyday users are now producers too. And what's funny again is companies are so concerned with what happens in the social web that they spend night and day monitoring and collecting posts and analyzing them. And so, you know, they are now also, you know, they've become an audience for all the posts that we create. So that is an interesting moment as well. And it's not just media companies. You know, I think about, you know, even the reason that we built our social media analytics command center is really, you know, we're doing a lot of, you know, job training in addition to the literacy work for people who will go out and do, you know, this kind of customer service and marketing research and you know, even journalism work that says, you know, we've got to read everything that everybody's posting out there to better understand trends and opinions and public sentiment.
One thing I would push back on the shift with traditional media or legacy media, especially at the local level, there's been such a failing buyouts of local papers because there is a lot of individual coverage around where, you know, the Patch and Twitter and things like that. And I have a concern about what's happened to the small papers medium-sized papers that are now been replaced by these big flagships are our only, regional voices. But I do take your point that, the participatory culture and talking back to the larger media is absolutely a value, and they're in that system.
Well, and I can talk from experience too in terms of our own. We're a pretty small market in Illinois. We're Bloomington, Normal. We're maybe 150 to 170,000 people, so not nowhere near as big as the Chicagoland area or anything like that. But we have seen something of a resurgence of certain kinds of local media. We've got a very powerful, I wouldn't say powerful, but a very active public radio station who in recent years has figured out that local content is extremely important right now. In fact, people are really craving local content because in all of those mergers that have come at the top, there's been so many buyouts that everybody's reading the same thing now, and so they're getting all the same content from everywhere, which is always national and political. And they say, "Well, I really want to know what's happening at town council. Who's covering that?" And again, we've had some very good, local media that's developed, and then also seen that social media can provide that additional supplement and platform. So even if people aren't listening all the time, they will go to the Facebook and Twitter handles as their local news sources as well. And I'll counter your counter with that a little bit too. I think there are openings right now. I think we've seen, and devastatingly so, I think we have seen a major decline over the past, 10, 15, well, even longer, that probably 20 years. But then there have been some very, very interesting openings. Again, in the journalism industry, we see a lot of conversation about the return to local, a lot of projection as to that being the next area of big growth.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I ask you, before we shift gears a little bit, to explain algorithmic thinking and what that means?
Yeah. And that's a great term for all sorts of things. So it's normally used by folks in computer science, really, to talk about how you code to basically streamline problems down into a series of standardized steps. And so, if you are if you're a person going to computer science, you learn how to make your code the most efficient thing possible. And in many ways, it I don't want to say it eliminates outside thinking, but your goal is really efficiency and the ability to continually duplicate or replicate that kind of process. And for the world of social media analytics, algorithmic thinking is really all about how do we basically automate all of these kinds of posts that are coming in. How do we automate our understanding of what's happening? Because it's very time intensive. If you download a data set of let's say 10,000 tweets, and you have to go through and understand what's happening. Imagine your eyes crossing, looking at a spreadsheet like that, and being able to say, this many people are talking about this topic, and this many people are angry and frustrated, and so on and so forth. And being able to allow computers to basically run processes that streamline that for you saves an immense amount of time and work. But that thinking, and again, I'm glad you brought up that idea of thinking, so that the way we start to think about the world around us is something that we say, how do we quantify, how do we collect very efficiently organize, and again, make computers do that work for us over and over and over again. And that's the kind of thinking that's been applied everywhere. I don't think just about social media analytics, but I think about it's been going for years in sales. It's been going for years in higher education. Universities and even public schools think about students. They're collecting data about enrollment, and they're thinking about how do we standardize even the kinds of tests that they take. I mean, that's all involved in these processes of collecting, sorting, analyzing data about all these different things, whether it's kids taking tests or if it's Twitter posts. And again, it's this standardization and making something very efficient in the end. I don't know if that helps with that kind
it
of
does.
Process.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And I think it's a nice kind of segue into talking about libraries and social media, because I think, you know, in terms of like especially analytics, but social media in general, I think libraries overall kind of have a love-hate relationship with social media. Just to say that it's a great way to connect with the population that you serve. It's a great way, you know, to be in their pocket, to be on their phones. But also, I don't think librarians quite have social media figured out totally yet. Like, how do we do it efficiently? How do we incorporate it with the business we do? How do we avoid too much conflict on social media? I hate to say it, but there's we don't want to be in the midst of the community's fake news debates all the time. So I was wondering if you had advice that how librarians could effectively use social media and connect.
One of the first things we have to think about is, you know, what is the role of the library in your community? And, you know, I think about, you know, I'm in Normal, Illinois, and we've got a great public library that does, you know, so much more than just circulation. You know, it is really about being a community space for developing different kinds of literacies. You know, and so we've got all these STEM and STEAM clubs for kids. And so they'll come in and, you know, do work with 3D printing and Legos and engineering sets as well. As poetry months, as well as book clubs, as well as gathering space for all sorts of organizations and groups. So, I mean, it really depends on what your library's role is. And so, you know, if we're thinking about how do you best serve your community through social media, I mean, like you said, the first and best thing you can do really is to have an incredibly active presence that you are, you know, continuously reminding people of what it is that you do. If that's the top recommendation I can make, it is be as present as you possibly can. And that's difficult because you have to have somebody creating those posts and creating that content. I think a second point that I would, you know, strongly recommend is make yourself as human as possible too. There's so much bad social media out there in terms of content production, on behalf of organizations that it just looks like a standard page and there's no people in it ever. It's just event after event after event. And the more you can humanize and use that platform to say, you know, we're real people. We are people who, you know, live in your community. We're your neighbors. And we are, people whom you should be trusting because of that personal connection. That can be extremely important.
Can I ask then just to take it that step further about the analytics? And are there easy ways or accessible ways that librarians can utilize analytics, social media analytics in particular, of course, to learn about their communities and to better engage?
Sure. So I think the first way that, you know, anybody using social media can learn about analytics is to, if you are running a page for an organization, Facebook is probably one of the easiest examples here. If you are involved in running or editing one of those pages, get to know the insights section of the Facebook page itself. And that is, when you're managing that page, there's a tab up at the top. You click on insights, and it provides you a lot of in-depth information about, first of all, your posts. But I think a lot of people don't realize that there's also information about your current audience that you can reach. And so that insights page will again give you breakdowns of things like the gender demographics, the age demographics, the location demographics of people who are following and working with your site. Now, of course, that doesn't branch out into your whole community necessarily because it's your own page. But I can give you an example of some other tools for that in just a moment. Twitter also has an analytics page. And so if you are a library that runs a Twitter handle, the exact same kinds of tools are available if you just go to the site analytics.twitter.com and log in with your handle, you will get the same kinds of breakdowns that will show you, you know, how many people are engaging. Again, what I usually recommend for organizations is that you keep regular tabs on that. Create a monthly spreadsheet and just look at what is working and what isn't, change your plans accordingly from that. But in terms of, you know, maybe understanding your community, the world is really interesting in terms of how social media can reflect that. There are not a lot of easy ways, I would say, that, you know, I can send somebody out, like this afternoon and say, hey, go look at these sites and they'll teach you everything you need to know about your community. You know, those are questions that researchers and marketers and political analysts, are all constantly trying to figure out on a regular basis. If somebody had an easy tool for it, they would be very, very wealthy at this point. But I can recommend some interesting things that you can try to learn a little bit more about your community. If we're thinking, first of all, just about, let's say, the national or regional level, and you want to get a better understanding of what Twitter users in your area, again, let's say like the Chicago metro area. And what's really interesting about doing that is you just get a sense of again, what people, what they're talking about and how that's trending. And again, trending is this algorithmic concept for just really what is really popular within a particular time frame. There's a tool that I recommend people use called trends24.in, which is it's a website. I think it's actually hosted in India, which is why it has the .in internet address to it. And what it lets you do really is just search the most recent Twitter trends over the past 24 hours, and it breaks it down hour by hour, and it lets you search by worldwide, by states, by countries, and then really interestingly by major city and metro areas. So if your library is in a really big city and you just want to get a sense of what people are saying on Twitter near your location, you can look at that. Unfortunately, it doesn't cover everything. I'm sometimes frustrated by it because it doesn't provide Bloomington normal, but it provides Chicago and it provides St. Louis, and I can't just average between the two. There's a lot more going on here. But there's also a similar tool that's not free, but at least it can give you some insights if you're willing to explore, or if you're willing to maybe even support the company that provides it. It's called TrendsMap. So just trendsmap.com. And it shows you real-time Twitter trends really on a map, which is a very interesting way to see it. And it shows them in real time. And you can scroll over down to what I call the highway level. And you can see, what concepts are trending. And it's, if you keep track of that, you can get a really good sense of how opinions are shifting, or, again, what people really care about in your community. And you have to keep in mind, too, that Twitter is only, I think, maybe 8% of the 8% of the population uses Twitter. We're still looking at a subset, but it's a very efficient way to at least get something like a poll taken. And again, it's people who are self-selecting and talking about topics that matter to them.
Can we shift to the discussion about fake news?
And
I think that this connects with these trends. And what does the SMEC tell us about fake news?
So the SMEC itself, we're never sitting there watching everything. We never sit there going, hey, what's going on in the fake news bubble today? But what will happen is that we will be studying a particular hashtag, where we might be studying a particular celebrity or figure or whatever that might be. And again, like last fall, we were watching the election, and we were really spending a lot of time studying how people in very specific counties, these were counties in the swing states that were likely to determine the outcome of the election. And we were really following those ones just to get a sense of what people were saying and what their attitudes were towards the candidates. And so when we ask, what does the SMEC tell us about fake news, for us, it's really, we start to see a trend. And if that trend looks suspicious to us, that's that point where we kind of pull out the brakes, stop everything, and start to investigate further. In terms of the kinds of projects we would work on, we might see something really bizarre, like, I think it was at the Democratic Party staffer, Seth Rich, who I think was murdered, during the campaign. And there was all sorts of fake news about, that it was a hit job, and that's continued on. And I think it's still continuing on in some of the news cycles out there. Seeing stories like that, and seeing the Pizzagate stuff, and seeing, a lot of these really classic stories were things that, we would see in particular places that we were studying. And for us, it is a question of, those things look suspicious. We're trained to see certain things, and when things look suspicious, we'll pull the brake and take a look and drill down more deeply to see what's going on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the bubbles that we live in, because we, especially in the library community, we talk a lot about that, our filter bubbles, our information bubbles. I wanted to know your thoughts on how tight are these bubbles? Can we break into them if a if a trend hits, is there a counter trend that pushes back against it? Or is it really that buffered from the outside?
Well, it's funny you mentioned like counter trends. And what's funny is you will see a counter trend develop, but it doesn't necessarily bump into the other bubble. So we'll see a story, you know, emerge like, you know, Pizzagate or whatever. And you'll get people who believe very deeply in that, and that story, you know, will get shared, you know, to millions of other users. And then the counter story, again, which may be produced by mainstream media, you know, you'll have an entirely different bubble listening to, again, the counter story or the reporting. And it never breaks through. They don't touch. I mean, we see these really polarized, you know, maps when we look at you know, groups of people following these things. So I think that's kind of a funny way to think about it. You know, they don't live in a bubble in terms of our awareness of them, but I think the bubbles exist in terms of who, you know, believes or disbelieves what is seen. If that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, it does. It's kind of frightening, actually. I was really hoping you were going to say, oh no, the bubbles merge and we have a way that we correct the narrative. But
yeah, and in terms of correcting the narrative, you know, that's a very, you know, tricky thing, because really, you know, I've compared a lot of what's been going on to, you know, information warfare. You know, it's about who can strike the hardest and who strikes first. And which is, I think, even more terrifying thing to think about right now is that this is, you know, there are a lot of circles, both, you know, academic as well as political, talking about this as truly being warfare. You know, all you have to do is get a whole lot of people believing something for a short period of time, and it doesn't matter how many retractions are out there. It's out there, and it's going to be doing damage already. The question, of course, is you know, correcting it. Not so much as is it possible, but I think how do we keep it from getting there in the first place? You know, it's more of a question of deterrence rather than mitigating the effects. I think, you know, as we'll probably brush on in just a few minutes here, you know, that this is one of the major jobs of universities and journalists and libraries that we'll see. You know, how do we mitigate that before we even get there?
You know, we often, when we see the fake news thing, we often hear, you know, like it's the Russians or Eastern Europe or somewhere. I guess I just kind of wanted to ask, is that true? Like, where do you see these stories originating in these, you know, barrage of attacks? You know, what should we be thinking about that in terms of, you know, relevance to countering it?
Well, here's the thing, they're coming from everywhere. So that's the other terrifying thing. And especially when we think about, you know, just networks. I mean, we are all in some way connected to one another by, you know, a certain number of degrees. So to answer the question about, you know, Russia, as we're finding out more and more, yes, Russia had a big part to play in disinformation campaigns. I think just this past week, both Facebook and Twitter have been called to Capitol Hill to answer for how Russia deliberately bought misleading advertisements to be produced. We're seeing more and more numbers of Twitter bots that have been created to deliberately perpetuate and distribute fake news, and those are created in Russia, some of the Baltic states. Macedonia right now is a hotbed of it. And it's not even just social media. It is the purchasing and the distribution of certain kinds of websites. And so it's not just you know, buying a Twitter bot or buying Facebook ads. It is, you know, almost as easy as just buying a blog and buying many different blog sites and trying to make them look a little bit like a real news page, which is not hard. Not hard at all with all the publishing tools that are available now. And again, finding ways to just make something travel and get shared. So yeah, the question is, or the answer to that is, you know, they're really coming from everywhere. And again, there are different motives for this. There are, you know, obviously, you know, internationally, there are you know, we think about Russia's, you know, involvement. That is very much, you know, political and international relations motivation, you know, about international relations of power. When we think about locally, I mean, there are, you know, groups that, you know, they believe that they will benefit politically in this country if they engage in disinformation campaigns. And again, they treat it like warfare among the different political parties in this country. So they will get involved. We see, I think it's kind of interesting because oftentimes people will talk about, well, the Onion, you know, well, they're a fake news organization. And we say, yes, and we know they are. And, you know, and so there are groups like the Onion that do satire. But I think there is definitely a, you know, distinct difference that we can, you know, talk about too there as well, as when we think about, you know, all the different kinds of fake news as well.
It's, you know, it's one thing, even if you think of like the National Review or the Nation, you know, to be reporting through a political lens, but still be following journalistic practice and to be totally cut loose from journalistic codes of ethics, period. And I think we have trouble recognizing that definitely in this online environment.
Yeah, and I think what's extremely dangerous right now is that I've heard it described, I think it was actually Steve Inskeep, one of NPR's you know, morning anchors, who described it as, it's actually not that we're having a post-truth moment, we're having a post-trust moment. Mm-hmm. And our ability to, again, trust sources is what's really been destroyed lately because of, again, everything that you just brought up there.
You know, I mentioned earlier the focus on information literacy skills, this shift with the infrastructure, and we keep talking about how it's shared and we don't know what to trust as websites are built. And I think there's a key question that I have as I've interviewed psychologists and talked to journalists, you know, are we facing a problem of infrastructure where we're learning to handle this new information technology and we're going to figure this out? Or is this a cognitive problem that we need to deal with ourselves, where we need to be better, more information literate? We need to be tougher consumers of information, or perhaps both?
It is definitely both. And I can tell you that you know, infrastructure-wise, again, as I kind of hinted at earlier, the economics make it so that all you want to do, you know, if you're going to make a whole lot of money through the internet right now, is just get a lot of people sharing something and you will collect on the ad revenue. And so the more controversial, the more outlandish and outrageous that it is, the more clicks you're going to get, the more money you're likely to make. And so the incentive is not there to, you know, create something that is factual, create something that is slow, create something that is thoughtful. It, you know, all those things that go into traditional and ethical journalism, right? You know, those are not, you know, currently, according to these structures, you know, economically desirable. So that is certainly there. I think the ways in which we, you know, interact and consume social media on a daily basis, and even, you know, the infrastructures of the platforms themselves, you know, lend themselves to bubbles so easily. You know, if you don't like what you see on Facebook, you turn it off. If you don't, you know, if you don't want to see something for a particular person on Twitter, you block them. And so it's very easy to create those bubbles. And I remember right after the election, I gave a talk to a group, and one of the first things I said is, you know, go out and find everybody you unfollowed or blocked, you know, during the election, and reconnect with them if you can, and maybe that will create some healing. And I think I'm still skeptical. I maybe want to kind of turn myself around there and say, maybe that's a little naive, because again, it takes such active work, whereas the default is to, you know, allow, you know, these bubbles to form. So the infrastructure is there to keep creating this, and the economic incentives are there to keep creating, you know, this divisiveness, and again, this you know, totally fake economy. And the companies really don't have the ability to control it, as we're finding right now with all these congressional investigations. You know, Facebook, you know, initially said, oh, no, there's no fake news problem, and now they're saying, well, there was, but it wasn't that bad. And, you know, we keep finding out how little control they have over it. But I think that cognitive side that you mentioned too, there is, just leading out of what we just, you know, mentioned in terms of those bubbles, we really only want to hear what we want to hear. We want to have our perspectives confirmed. We want those biases confirmed on a regular basis. And that is incredibly hard to undo. And I think about, you know, how can we undo that a little bit? And I think about, you know, journalism is one of those spaces where we see that happen. I think of, you know, papers like the New York Times, their digital editions are very good about on a regular basis. I think it's almost daily. They will publish a story that is, here's what the other side is thinking. And they will publish a collection of partisan writing from multiple perspectives. And it's not simply, you know, left versus right. I mean, they will provide a really large swath of voices on an issue that are very well curated. And so there's at least ways to kind of poke at that bubble and poke at that shell. But not everybody's reading New York Times, right. Which is, part of this issue too. And not every organization that is, a news organization can afford to spend the time to create that kind of environment.
I mean, and we've lived in our bubbles pre-internet. I mean, like the old saying, the things you don't talk about, right? Politics, religion, and the Bears versus the Packers, or whatever, wherever you live.
Cubs in the car.
Yeah, there you go. So, we have ways that we've built our bubbles in the past, but I think they're even more self-reinforcing online. One thing that I really enjoyed is the Pew had a political typography quiz that you could take, and to really kind of self-examine where you fall into your own, and it's not just the right versus left spectrum, but it's a whole range of types where you can better understand your views, which I think helps you be more reflective as you see information. Like, what information do I fall for? Because here's what my political beliefs happen to fall. And I think that's a good way to start with some of this, perhaps, is individually understand ourselves so we're more vaccinated against some of the ugly stuff that comes our way.
Vaccination's a metaphor I hear a lot, and there's sometimes problems with that too that are hard for me to articulate at the moment. But I think about so in addition to the teaching I'll do, and in addition to the good journalism that's out there, I look at the role of libraries right now, and I actually spent last summer a really good amount of time working with one of our librarians at the Milner Library, our university library here at Illinois State, developing a libguide or a library guide to, I think we titled it, Promoting Online Civic Reasoning and Media Literacy. And it was, it's really about fake news, and it's all of these different perspectives. So first of all, how to identify fake news? And that's, as you mentioned, literacy issues. I mean, that's maybe the first points of contact for a lot of people, is just saying, is this real or not? Or is this being produced to get me to, be outraged and click on it and give somebody a dime for clicking on it, as opposed to actually giving me information? But part of the guide that we developed is also building those core competencies of research and of verifying and fact-checking. And, of course, these are all slow processes, which is really hard when we live in a space where our students are flying through their Twitter feeds faster than they can stop to even read any of it. So
right.
Taking that time to slow down can be very difficult, but again, we do have these guides, and again, they are about questions of how do we identify it, how do we do fact checking, how do we what kinds of digital tools are available for doing that fact checking as well, and there's a list out there, and I'll send it to you so you can share it with your audience as well.
Fantastic, that would be great. And you've touched on this. Are there other things that libraries could do to be positioned to combat the spread of fake news?
Earlier I had mentioned that kind of difference between trust and truth, and I think libraries need to kind of maintain that sense that they're a place that can be trusted, that you can go up and talk to a librarian, and that person is going to help you find information, and do so in a way that they respect you, they respect what you're looking for, but will also, go through some of these steps that say, okay, here's what authority means. Here is what, good sources of information are. And we'll hopefully maybe even challenge patrons a little bit here as well. But all while maintaining that level of trust. I think we still see libraries, I hope we still see libraries as institutions of trust. And again, maintaining them, if we think about social media, it is one of those platforms where they continue to maintain that. Libraries really, they're in a great position to, if
there's the time and resources in your community available to host, short seminars and, fact checking, sessions where, you can teach people to use some of these tools and to, again, provide that space and that knowledge base. I think, again, libraries as being a place for us to run into other people is also going to be really important. Because what we're really used to right now is, going into an online space where we don't have to care about the other person or other people out there. We can be, the jerks that we want to be in online spaces because there are consequences for that when we're somewhat anonymous or, when there aren't living, breathing other people, in front of us. I think libraries offering a space where there's kind of, more of a communal, information gathering and a communal resource, it brings out the better in people when you've got to be with other people. So I think that's something else we should keep in mind. I mean, fostering those face-to-face environments and relationships are something that libraries still offer that social media don't necessarily offer.
If our listeners wanted to connect with you online, what's the easiest way to do that?
So I run a Twitter handle for the Social Media Analytics Command Center, which is at ISUSOC_SMAC, and SMAC is SMACC. So you can look for us there. People can also learn about the SMAC and at least some of what we do by going to the School of Communications website and looking looking up the SMAC. In fact, just a quick Google search for SMAC in Illinois State will bring up our facilities as well.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I appreciate the time, and thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta, with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. Help others find the show by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. Follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or the show's Facebook page. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening and keep circulating your ideas.